Welcome to National Treasure Hunt, the podcast where the secret lies not only with Charlotte, but also with your co-hosts. I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And I'm really excited to share with you all today that we are deep diving into a fictional entity today.
Is that a first?
I think it is. We normally...
Like a full fictional entity?
Yeah. I mean, as we will get into, it's definitely an analogy to non-fictional things, but I do think it is the first time we will have explored to a great extent something that's entirely fictional.
I mean, I'm pumped.
That fictional thing is Cross S. Nostrum, made famous in National Treasure, Edge of History. We're going to have a whole convo before the convo when we start the bulk of this episode. So why don't we get our traditional business out of the way, Em? I think we should jump right into our screams from Parkington Lane. All right, Emily, you often complain to me offline that you feel like you don't have a lot of screams to share. Do you have one to share this evening?
Well, I like that you asked that as if I would be allowed to come without one.
She learns.
Yes. So it actually happened today when I was driving home from work. And there was, I feel like I do it. This is the equivalent of your dream screams. I saw a bumper sticker on the back of someone's car that was like a circle and it had a triangle inside of it. And I immediately thought it was a Freemason symbol, and it wasn't.
Was it not like the Deathly Hallows or something?
No, it was like an actual thing. But no, it wasn't a Freemason symbol. But I got really excited for a second, and then I like had to keep checking to make sure it wasn't actually that. So yeah.
Emily Black seeing Freemason symbols everywhere.
Yeah. Scary. How about you?
You did take the wind out of my sails, and I am sharing a dream from Parkington Lane this week. It's a pretty simple one, but one that was very devastating in the moment when I thought it was really happening. Honest to God, I had a dream that I was like on Disney Plus and the movies and show were gone.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Which... Y'all, remember a few months ago, there were all these headlines because Disney was taking a ton of titles off of Disney Plus and Hulu. And it wasn't just a bunch of old stuff. They were also taking off titles that were fairly new. And I think we talked about it on the pod or on the Patreon or something. But I think that lent some realism to this dream. And it then, I, of course, in the dream, I then panicked because our whole thing here at National Treasure Hunt has been they won't take National Treasure off of Disney Plus because they'll use it to hype up National Treasure 3. So that is my scream this week.
Wow. Yeah, scary stuff. Glad you didn't have to worry about it, but yeah, stressful.
Thank you. Well, the other thing that we have to share in our scream segment this week is a brief scream coming from one of our National Treasure super fans over on Patreon. This scream comes from Lillian, and she actually shared this with us when we hosted our recent winter watch party for some of our Patreon subscribers, Em. Given the topic of the scream, I feel it only appropriate for you to be the one to present it.
Yes, thank you. So yeah, Lillian was telling us and the other patrons during our live watch when I made a comment about the music in National Treasure Book of Secrets that because of all the analysis of music she hears us do on the podcast, she has now become very attuned to listening to music in films. And she told us that in the newest Top Gun film, she was paying particularly close attention to the music and really enjoyed it. And I just want to say, well done, Lillian. I'm glad that we are able to pass on this knowledge and ability to pay attention to music. Please continue to do so.
Well, y'all, you can join Lillian and our other subscribers on Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast. There are tons of perks over there, but hey, one quick example, if you join at any tier, you will be able to get exclusive episode preview videos with behind the scenes insights from our recording. But that's not the only way you can engage with us.
You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We're also available at nthuntpodcast.com. And please go ahead and order our book, National Treasure Hunt, One Step Short of Crazy, at tuckerdspress.com.
All right, Emily, are we ready to dive into the mythical organization that is Cross S Nostrum, or as I like to write in my podcast notes, CEN?
Yes, let's do it. I also wrote CEN.
I'm rubbing off on you. We love it. Okay, so I want to preface this for our listeners by saying you and I am. Literally, since we learned what Cross S Nostrum was as we were watching the show as it was airing, I think you and I came to the consensus we would eventually be doing this episode.
Oh, 100%. I mean, there's no way to get around it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first time in National Treasure lore that we have an entire organization acting as our villain, and they have really quite unique and troubling motives, which are worthy of an entire episode of this podcast that likes to deep dive into things. So, what we're going to do today, we're going to start with some Edge of History context, make sure we all remember what National Treasure Edge of History told us about Cross S Nostrum to begin with. And then we're going to start having more of a theoretical conversation about how we as viewers are meant to interpret the organization. We're going to talk a bit about the concept of revisionist history and how we believe this concept relates to Cross S Nostrum. We're going to dive into a little bit of what something like Cross S Nostrum would look like in real life. And we'll wrap up with a bit of lighthearted discussion about whether and how Cross S Nostrum fits into National Treasure 3.
I'm really excited for that part.
I am trepidatious about that part because I don't know which direction the conversation is going to go.
I guess we'll have to see.
All right, well, we have to start at the beginning. For anyone who hasn't watched Edge of History in a while or might have forgotten, we need to dive into what the show tells us about this villainous organization. I say that because in retrospect, the show actually tells us very little. Did you realize that, Em, when you were revisiting, like, to plan this episode?
I did. It's interesting because they're the big bad, but we don't really like meet all the players until later on. And then, I mean, we don't meet Salazar until, we meet him, I guess, in the first National Treasure film, but we don't meet him in the context of Salazar until like the second to last episode. So I think because of that kind of slow burn, it, yeah, th there just wasn't much there.
It's one of those things where I needed season two if only to get more info on Cross S Nostrum. I have so many questions, okay? So for those of you listening in episode 9 of Edge of History, Cross S Nostrum is described as a cabal, which is defined by the Oxford Dictionary as a secret political clique or faction. Now, this episode purports that Cross S Nostrum has existed throughout history for centuries, and their role throughout history has been finding and destroying lost treasures. Now, in the present day, Cross S Nostrum is somehow directed by a board of old white men, as shown literally in episode 4.
We love to
But
see it.
we never learn what exactly that board's role is in relation to Salazar, who is the organization's like figurehead or leader. This bugs me to no end, just side note.
I assume that they kind of told him what to do. Did you not?
I really don't know. I don't know if it was fully thought through. I think having the board of old white men was meant to be just specifically for imagery, having Billy in front of those men to like show the dichotomy there and to have a bit of social commentary. I don't know that it was fully thought out. I would love to be proven wrong, and maybe we add this to our perpetual list of Ask the
True, yeah.
Wibs.
R write it down.
We say this all the time, and this is the one thing I never write down, just for the record.
Oh my
Like,
gosh.
hey, you could write something down.
No.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Anyway, in episode 10, the season, series finale of Edge of History, we get what I would personally consider the most important background information on Cross S. Nostrum in one very short exchange between Hendrix, who is Salazar, and Billy. And it's in front of this conversation is happening in front of Jess and Raphael when they're on that like pontoon boat in the Devil's Swamp. And I think that we should read this conversation verbatim because it is short but so important. So how about this? I'll play Salazar and you can be Billy. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Oh, I'm not changing my voice or anything. We just need the exchange to
Okay.
happen.
Okay.
Okay. So, Salazar says, "We're not here to get rich. We're here for the greater good. When secrets of the past get unburied, it rewrites history. It creates conflict, war. People suddenly feel cheated out of something they never even knew they had."
The Pan-American treasure is a political powder keg. Cross S. Nostrum keeps the status quo.
"Tomorrow is ours because yesterday is ours too." I've got to say, now I'm not playing Salazar anymore, guys. Back to being Aubrey.
There's such a difference.
I've got there is. Please say there is.
There is. It was a
Oh
joke.
my God. This is what, like five sentences? It says so much.
Oh, it does.
So we're going to keep coming back to this, you guys. Wanted to make sure that you had that context because it is so important, yet simultaneously, it's like the only real information we have on this organization. So let's start, Emily, by talking a little bit about how we as an audience are supposed to interpret the conversation we just read, how we're supposed to interpret Cross S. Nostrum as a cabal. When I was examining this, I feel the need to clarify that we do not know what exactly what the Wibberleys were trying to portray or make us think. But I think it's fair for us to ask ourselves, what do we think the creative team was trying to parallel from real life, since we know that Edge of History was meant to be very modern, very like in the present day, and reflective of current issues in the world. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, and I think, it's important to note that, this is something we do with everything in the National Treasure franchise. So this is not a first for us to kind of try to figure out what we think the creative team was trying to portray. So I think we're really just kind of like leaning into our brand in doing this.
Yeah, the analysis. Okay, so for me, I will admit I did not know the technical definition of a cabal before today, and you're shaking your head. I'm assuming I'm not the only one.
Oh no, I had no idea.
Well, I gotta say, I'm really glad I looked it up because I think it's really telling that it was a very explicit word choice. Cabal is literally defined as a political faction. And they chose that word, cabal, intentionally. which I would argue means the creative team was making their villains political.
Yeah, I mean, they could have used another term if they didn't want it to be affiliated with a political like thing.
Totally. And when I say political, I'm not even saying like left or right or anything like that. Just the concept, it's a political faction. So I think that's really important to recognize, and that alone was a huge revelation for me. I did not know that in advance. Now, the premise of Edge of History as a show is to emphasize the importance of rediscovering and preserving lost cultures. And we also know that the creative team was trying to illuminate via the Malinche story specifically. We covered that a few weeks ago. This idea of recognizing contributions to history, especially those that have been minimized. So to me, it therefore seems clear that the creative team is implying that a political villain, in this case, Crossas Nostrum, is responsible for lost cultures and lost history staying lost, at the very least, right? Because Crossas Nostrum says that's their goal, to make sure that lost treasures, for example, are never found.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely.
So then I guess the question becomes, what is a political villain?
Yeah. I mean, somebody who does bad things with power.
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. And of course, we can all agree that the term bad is subjective in the
Oh,
grand
yeah.
scheme of the world. Like, bad things can be interpreted in many ways, but I think that's a definition we can all kind of agree to, right? That a political villain would be someone who uses power to do something that the individual assessing the action deems as not great. But in the context of this show, I think we could take it a step further to assess Crossas Nostrum specifically. I think we would say that in the context of Edge of History, a political villain is an influential person who chooses to propagate a version of history that's factually incorrect. In this case, factually incorrect with respect to cultures and contributions to history.
Yes, and I agree. And I want to say this is with the, like, hopefully obvious implication that Crossas Nostrum knew what they were doing in destroying these treasures. Like, they understood the historical context that these treasures brought to
Right.
light. So they had that foreknowledge, and therefore I completely agree with what you just said, because they know the information is factually incorrect, but they're still,
It's like
that
a
is what they're choosing to do.
willing, conscious decision.
Yes.
It's not like accidental, I guess.
Right. Or at least I guess they fear the unknown. If it like you know, maybe the old white men,
In the
right,
boardroom.
in the boardroom didn't 100% understand like the exact context of, you know, the Pan American treasure that we see in Edge of History, but they at least were fearful that if it came to light, it would change things in a way that was not favorable to them, or in a way that would cause more problems, in their opinion, than it solved.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Okay, as we wrap up this sort of overarching assessment of what we think the creative team was trying to convey, I just keep coming back to that last Salazar quote, the one that says, "Tomorrow is ours because yesterday is ours too." I feel like I'm going to keep coming back to this today because it's so telling. And I think the use of this exact line means that the creative team is trying to make a reference, and I am talking broader than Edge of History here. I think they're trying to make a reference to people in the world who are opposed to, let's say, progress, whatever progress looks like in the eyes of the viewer. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because that's the whole thing. If tomorrow is ours because yesterday is ours too, then some things cannot change from yesterday to today.
I mean, I feel like it's this, it's this idea of wanting to keep the status quo static.
Yes. That's exactly. I personally, I think this is a great example. This quote, it's just so poignant because we can all determine how we interpret what it means to oppose progress based on our own perspectives and lenses as a viewer. So for me, I personally interpret this as a reference to people who have been disenfranchised in history, them remaining disenfranchised. So, for example, when people have historically not had easy access to their polling places, and we see situations that keep them in that challenging state instead of making, in this case, a polling places easier for them to access, or communities in historically redlined districts not being given access to infrastructure or to services that they have been historically denied access to. That's how I personally interpret it, but I'm sure there are other ways too.
Yeah, I was gonna say the way that I interpret it is not even with this concept of like it doesn't have to be a in my interpretation, it doesn't have to be a disenfranchisement. It can literally be as simple as people don't like change. And like don't necessarily see beyond what benefits them. So I'm thinking, I was actually just having this conversation with Josh, the other day about like student loans, right? Some people think that student loans should be forgiven, some people don't. But typically in those situations, it's less a matter of like, oh, I want to keep the people down. And it's more a matter, in my opinion, of I already did this thing, so I'm looking at it from my perspective of like I already gave money to this, so I don't want to give more money to this type of thing. And the same could be said for something like taxes. Like if people are used to paying a certain amount in taxes, I can see, if they really like the status quo to not want that amount to change necessarily, because it innately change the way that those people would have to live their lives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. And I think it's a really great example of how many different ways this motivation of Crossos Nostrum can be interpreted, regardless of the viewer's, belief system or where they're at in their lives. And to me, I think that makes it a really, just to pat the creative team on the back a little bit, truly, what a worthy villain to create. That permits all of this discussion and this ability to relate different belief systems or overlay different belief systems on top of it to analyze what makes it a villain, if that makes sense.
Yes, and I think along those lines, I just want to say, like, I think Crossos Nostrum was created in such a way where anybody watching it can view Crossos Nostrum as the quote unquote bad guys, regardless of what they're bringing to the table. It's
Good
not like
point.
anybody feels particularly, because we've talked on the pod about how a lot of people didn't, or some people didn't like Edge of History because there was a female lead, or that there were too many like progressive concepts represented, right? And you know, that's one of the reasons why people didn't like the show. But from, you know, our intense kind of following of this on social media, I've not seen anyone say, oh, I didn't like this show because I felt particularly victimized in the sense that, like, I saw myself as the villain, right? And I think that's what you, I don't necessarily want to say that's what you want in all forms of media, because I do think there are people out there who, you know, they're like particularly create media so that you find yourself identifying with the villains in a way that's like unfavorable. But that was not the intention here. And I don't think that anybody felt that that was the intention, which I think is a really big deal. Like, I think that's very well done.
Especially when it was so clear that they wanted to make this relevant to the modern day, and there is so much division in how people believe in things. So I think that was not an easy task, and I do think they accomplished it.
Definitely.
So we started actually talking a little bit about this at the end of this last segment, if you will, but I want to move beyond what the Wibberleys or the creative team may have wanted us to think, big picture about Cross S. Nostrum, what they hoped we would do in terms of consulting our own belief systems and perspectives when watching this show. And I want to think about how we could potentially analogize Cross S. Nostrum to the present day. Because I'm sorry, y'all, it's just not super common that you find massive history redefining treasures. Like, frequently. So unfortunately, we can't really say, like, oh, we can compare this to the discovery of XYZ treasure that happens every year or something. No, but there
Right.
are situations that I think parallel Cross S. Nostrum's motives, especially when we think about how Cross S. Nostrum is trying to preserve a certain image of what history looks like. So, Emily, I know when you and I were talking about this, like in prep, one of the two of the first topics that came to mind for you were removing the history of slavery from textbooks and removing statues of historical figures, potentially like problematic historical figures, from public places. So, do you want to talk about these concepts a little bit and how they could relate to Cross S. Nostrum?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that, you know, with everything we've said about the motives of Cross S. Nostrum before, both of these examples fit very well. So I'll start with the idea of removing, you know, slavery from textbooks. I do want to just say, like, blanket wise, like, people were enslaved, like, slavery is real and it did happen. However, there are some school districts that are choosing to remove slavery from their history textbooks. And in some cases, I think this is because, you know, people in power, at least the people that are making these decisions, don't necessarily think younger children like need to or should be learning about these particularly intense kind of like negative aspects of American history. But I do think that in a large majority of cases, the decision to remove slavery from textbooks is because the people making these decisions don't like the picture that slavery paints. They don't like the way that it makes the United States look. And I will say that something we talked about with Cross S. Nostrum, right, that we really emphasized was this idea that, you know, it's possible there are different levels of understanding within the organization about what exactly the treasure in Edge of History was, or how important it was, right? So, you know, we were saying that the men in the boardroom, maybe they knew that there was a chance the treasure could have been something that altered history, but they might not have known the specifics about it, right? But Billy and Salazar 100% knew what they were doing. Like, they knew the history they were attempting to, because they ultimately did not succeed, erase, right? And I do have to say that, like, it is a little unclear to me whether or not the individuals that are making the decisions about removing slavery from textbooks know how prevalent slavery was, or necessarily believe how prevalent it was, you know?
Yeah, where I think this gets interesting is trying to relate this back directly to Cross S. Nostrum. And I almost feel like the case you've made for analogizing this case to the organization is looking down the line, right? Because in the case of removing slavery from textbooks, we're taking a topic that most people, I would argue, are generally familiar with the topic that slavery happened in America and trying to erase that. Whereas Cross S. Nostrum is taking, let's say, a treasure that represents a whole history that is not known and erase that. So are you kind of saying like Cross S. Nostrum is what happens down the line if all history textbooks? Like slavery is gone and now no one knows it exists anymore.
Yeah, it would almost be if no one knew it existed anymore, and suddenly, like, new evidence was discovered to demonstrate something, Cross S. Nostrum kind of would, like, stamp down that evidence, because nobody, you know,
Right.
would know eventually.
Right. Wow. That's interesting to think about. That Cross S. Nostrum could be a present day, but also like a future consideration almost. So, what about the case of removing statues of historical figures from public places?
Yeah, so I think in a lot of ways, I do think that this is similar to the previous example, and something that would need to be kind of considered down the line. However, I liked this example because, you know, statues are a physical thing, right? And Cross S. Nostrum was trying to destroy a physical treasure. So there is that kind of that element to it. So, I mean, everybody's probably aware that, you know, recently there's been a push to remove statues of historical figures, particularly in the United States, that did controversial things, right? It doesn't have to be that their entire life was controversial, but they made some decisions that people are looking at differently now than they used to. And so, I guess, you know, an example that I was thinking of specifically is removing statues of Confederate generals from the Civil War because of their support for slavery, or honestly, removing statues of presidents for the same thing, right? Now, generally, the rationale behind wanting to remove these statues is this idea of not glorifying someone who did horrific things. But by removing these statues, right, we are physically removing markers of history on both a people go and visit this on their class field trip level, and a at one point in time, people erected these statues because they felt that it was important level of history. And so it's kind of the same idea, I think, that I'm getting at. And I know we're going to talk about a little bit more later, but I want to, like, toss it in here real quick of this concept of, you know, revisionist history potentially, and that it seems that removing these statues would be not exactly what Cross S. Nostrum would do, but possibly.
But I mean, depending on what sort of version of history they were trying to preserve, that's very possible, right? Because I love what you said about they are destroying tangible things. You don't get much more tangible than a giant, statue of a person that once existed. So, wow, that's actually really interesting. I think it analogizes actually quite well.
Okay, awesome. So, do you have an example?
I mean, it kind of goes with what you were just talking about in terms of removing, when you said especially removing statues of like past presidents, because the first thing that came to mind for me was the way we choose to talk about the American founding fathers. Even 10, 15 years ago when we were in school, it was a lot less common to put emphasis on the fact that the majority of our founding fathers were slave owners. And now in 2024, it is increasingly common, and I personally believe rightfully so, that when we talk about the important contributions of these figures to the establishment of our country, we acknowledge that they had flaws, and specifically flaws that don't exactly jive with our belief systems and our understanding of human rights. But, there are still people who don't understand why it's important to put that piece of the conversation about, the founding fathers being slave owners into the broader context for whatever reason. I think one of the arguments that I have heard most frequently is the idea that, why are we learning about these founding fathers to begin with? It's because they drafted the Declaration, or because they led the Continental Army, or they signed the Constitution. Like, so why we're not talking about a biography of them, we're just talking about this contribution. And so I think people have different views, of course, on whether or not and how often and when we are talking about founding fathers in different lights. So I think this is pretty relevant. I like it. I actually like it less than your statues example, because I really just think there's something to be said for the analogy of like the physical history. But that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah, so can I ask you a follow-up on that?
Sure.
So, are you saying that if we were to kind of like equate this to Crossus Nostrum, is your thought that Crossus Nostrum, like one of the ways they could be working in like a modern day, society would be to choose to talk about the founding fathers, or that they would be people that would not want to kind of like dredge up some of this more unsavory stuff?
I think it completely depends on your belief system.
Yeah,
That's the
okay, that's
thing.
why I
Like,
asked.
yeah, you could see it both ways, because in a weird way, I think the two examples you gave reflect two completely different belief systems. And the way you interpret the Founding Fathers one, yeah, you could say a Crossus Nostrum could be trying to change our picture of the Founding Fathers by making it clear that they were, had these flaws. Or you could say that Crossus Nostrum would want to stamp down the people who want to make that clear, because either way, we're changing the way we view history. And I think it gets to an interesting broader question of like history itself and our understanding of it is fluid. It's why, like, when we go to a place like Mount Vernon, the people there, the tour guides, are called interpretive specialists. Their job is to interpret history based on, all the primary and secondary sources and the artifacts and the social context in which we are operating.
Yeah, and Aubrey, oh my gosh, I love that you brought this up, because I have like a little blurb in like our next section about like what I think history like is. And so I'm very excited, because it's kind of along those lines. I'm very excited. Sorry, I just did like a little Alexis thing from Schitt's Creek with like my voice in my hands, but I'm very excited to get there.
So, okay, before we get to that though, I think is there like one other this example that you have written here, I think in our notes is a good one. Why don't you at least quickly touch on it?
Yeah, so very quickly, land acknowledgments. Okay,
Yes.
so land acknowledgments, they're becoming a more common thing. It's basically where people make a statement about their knowledge that the land they are physically on was stolen from indigenous people. And while it may be interpreted by some people as being to some extent performative, I do think that it is also necessary personally to recognize and reckon with the mistakes that the country has made. So I think, it's I really like this example because it's a physical thing, with land. They're literally acknowledging this thing about land. But also, if we're thinking about Crossus Nostrum and we're thinking about what their goals were in Edge of History, specifically, it was referring to a Pan-American treasure coming from individuals who are normally, underrepresented in society. And I think that land acknowledgments tap into that kind of underrepresented nature in a similar manner. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, I think that land acknowledgments are a really good example of something that Crossus Nostrum would be very keen to not have exist, just based on the context of the Pan-American treasure almost being like the equivalent to land itself,
Yeah.
where it's like present day people. Present day Indigenous people didn't have their personal land stolen from them 300 years ago because they weren't around 300 years ago.
Right.
Just as the cultures and civilizations and communities that the Pan-American treasure would belong to today, they didn't own it themselves 300, hundreds of years ago. But their ancestors did, just like the indigenous people on the land, their ancestors did. And so I think this is actually quite analogous to Crossus Nostrum.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, but let's move on because we have a couple more things to touch on here in this episode.
Yeah, I think it's about time. You alluded to this earlier, Emily. I think we have to talk a little bit about the concept of revisionist history. Both in terms of looking at how history and our interpretation of it is shaped by the changing times, there is also something that you mentioned at the very beginning of this that I think is really relevant here, where people obviously don't really like change. It could be something as frivolous as your favorite show getting canceled, or it could be something as serious as a death in the family. Change is not super well received generally. So, revisionist history, I think, introduces this concept of like, are we hardwired to reject that which is different from what we know and are familiar with and we are comfortable with?
Right. And so I think, this is particularly interesting because in kind of fighting against this change, this idea of, rejecting something that's different from what is, typically known or familiar to us, Crossus Nostrum do that and they are painted as the quote unquote bad guy. But I think it brings to life this idea of like, do we, on some level, all do the same thing by rejecting?
That which is unfamiliar to us.
Yeah.
Oh boy, could this be a whole separate episode?
Probably.
Well, okay, I do think that when it comes to revisionist history, we need to make a bit of a dichotomy here because I don't know. Maybe on a personal level, I don't know if you agree with me, Em. I think that there's a moral difference between rejecting an idea because it's different from what you've been taught. And it's just like you're skeptical, you're not familiar, you need proof, like whatever. There's a difference between that and actively choosing to spread a narrative that you know is wrong.
Right. And in the case of Crossus Nostrum, the argument that we made earlier is that they know they
Right.
are intentionally spreading a narrative that is wrong, that is not true to what actually happened in history.
Exactly. And then this is where we could have a whole separate conversation if we wanted to, or maybe a quick one here about intent versus outcome when it comes to these sort of revisionist history conversations. Because in the case of Crossus Nostrum, they know what the information they're spreading is wrong. And the case of some hypothetical person who, on a different topic, they don't know that what they're saying is historically inaccurate. The outcome is the same. The wrong information is being spread, and that has its own damages potentially associated with it. But does the intent matter?
Yeah, so I actually oh gosh, this just brought up this thought to me of when we were reading that quote section in the beginning of the episode, one of the things in the quote was how new information could lead to like uprisings and wars and stuff like that. And in that case, right, with Crossus Nostrum, and even though they're actively choosing to spread a narrative that they know is wrong, they believe
They're doing the right thing.
they're doing it for the right reason. In which case, I think I totally agree that, like, there should be some kind of difference between, like, what you intend versus the outcome in terms of these ethical considerations. But if we're looking at it from like a Crossus Nostrum perspective, right? If they had managed to like destroy the treasure, theoretically the outcome would have been like not an additional war about these things. And I mean, we know that the outcome was also not an additional war, even though they didn't destroy this, but
Right.
they didn't know that.
Yeah. No, totally. It's so funny to me that you came to that kind of thesis on your own, because I have that further down in our notes. So like that, no, that's a good thing. I see you're making like, oh, I'm sorry face. No, don't be sorry. I think this is a really good place to have that conversation. They fully believe that they're doing the right thing. That doesn't mean they're doing the right thing, but they definitely believe it.
Yeah. And also the fact that, we're meant to be aware, right, that they are not doing the right thing in some ways kind of points to just overarching division in thought processes. Because if, we are able to identify that this is not the right thing, but this group of people thinks it's the right thing, technically, should we be able to do that about everything?
I think you might have just exploded my brain, because I don't know where to go from there.
So let's just move on. I have one more like example thing, and I'll make it brief. But this is along the lines of promoting a narrative that people know is incorrect, but possibly making it seem like maybe that's not a terrible thing. So yeah, interesting. So first I want to mention like the idea of like what history is. I talked about this a little earlier, right, when you kind of started to mention it. In reality, history is things that happened in the past, obviously. But history is also stories to some extent, right? The word story is literally in the word, right? And what makes history, quote unquote, like real is that we have more evidence, i.e., proof, for some stories than we do for others, which is, for example, why we know more about Hitler than we do about someone like Aristotle, right? There's more physical evidence, and surviving people who lived through something such as the Holocaust, whereas There's currently no one alive that knew Aristotle, and if someone is saying that, maybe they're a time traveler, I don't know. And so with that idea of like evidence and like removing things and whatnot, I think Christianity is actually a really good example of this. And I say this as someone who is a Christian myself, not in the like fundamental belief system, but in the quote unquote like history book that people read about Christianity, right? Which is the Bible. That there are books in the Bible that were officially removed, like way back in the day, probably by a group of old white men, honestly, if we're thinking about it, very similar to the boardroom that we see in Crossus Nostrum, right? Now, like pastors and priests, they're not preaching from those books that have been removed from the Bible, and people aren't typically reading those books. I'm certainly not, right? And so, in that sense, the Bible can be viewed as like this religious revisionist history text, but people still believe it, right? It's a very common, like, people are aware that there are books removed from the Bible. I am aware of this.
I was not aware of this. I learned
Oh.
something today.
Sorry, but I am aware of it, but I still am happy to accept what I know as the Bible to be the Bible, even though, now I'm wondering, like, I probably shouldn't be doing that, but I think that that speaks to this idea of like rejecting change, right?
Yeah. This case of the Bible is certainly interesting because it's very relevant to today. And I think everything that we've talked about today in terms of analogizing Crossus Nostrum, well, we intentionally did that to make it feel very relevant. But just as we said before, we're not as a civilization or as a society finding new treasures every day. Those don't really exist in a bounty like our favorite Disney features want us to think. Crossus Nostrum is also not real, which is why we have been having this kind of existential conversation. So, what would it take to create a Crossus Nostrum today? What would a Crossus Nostrum look like in real life? And I think we can take hints from the show to answer this question. I mean, number one is money, right? Billy is rich.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think of all the resources that were needed to do this.
Yeah, immense resources. I will say, would love to know about Salazar's resources. I don't get the impression that he is quite as well off as Billy
He's definitely
financially.
not pulling in hefty checks from the
No,
FBI.
not at all. But we are meant to believe, I think, that the boardroom is rich and they might be the financiers.
True, true.
That could be their role.
Like Ian.
We'll get to Ian, okay? We'll get there. So close. Besides money, what else do you need? Influence? Access to those with influence? I think another way of saying this is power, however you want to interpret the word power. But I like the word influence better because I think it can be broader than power. I think this can be political influence. I think this can be like media or narrative influence. I think both of those assets, political and media influence, would be very valuable for something like a Crossus Nostrum.
And then I think personally, like something else that it would take is like a good face for the organization, or a good like personality, let's say, for the organization. I think there is probably a distinct reason why Billy, aka Catherine Zeta-Jones, was the face of at least what we thought of for the majority of, right, the series, the face of Crossus Nostrum, not the old white men in the boardroom.
Right. Well, there's also, I think of this idea of personality and analogize it in a weird way to cults. You know, the person in charge of a cult always has a certain personality that is trustworthy, that is appealing to those they are trying to attract. And I think Billy is a great example of that as like the personality, the face, because she is clearly intelligent. She's beautiful. She's everything that the people who are, we would imagine to be aligned with Cross S. Nostrum based on what the show has told us, would really respect, perhaps.
Oh yeah, and I think there's a different version of Edge of History where, like, not actually that exists, but there could be, where the gang, like the Scooby gang, is like working with Billy unaware of who she is and trusting her for a longer period of time
Great
than
point.
what we see.
That's a great point. Now, I would argue that these key factors that we've pointed out, the money, the influence, and the personality, there are absolutely people that have all of these things. And I think it that like exist in real life, but yet they are not necessarily Cross S. Nostrum, right? It's how people use these assets that really counts. You know, fill in the blank with your favorite celebrity who you believe is, you know, socially active in a positive way. You know.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Aubrey, we've had some fun. We've had some very deep, deep discussions. But I think it's time that we bring this conversation back around to our favorite topic, which is National Treasure 3.
Isn't it everyone's favorite topic?
It should be.
It should be. I want us to wrap up by asking, could Cross S. Nostrum, or its like motives, its MO, its whatever, could it fit into the third film? I feel like I have a thesis answer on this myself, but you and I often disagree on things. I feel like often also in terms of National Treasure 3, so I'm like a little terrified with your answer to this question.
I would love to hear yours. And what, if you don't mind, what I'll do is like interject
Okay.
where I agree and disagree.
Okay. I feel the need to start my assessment by saying, for the record, I still do not fully buy that Ian Howe was Cross S. Nostrum, even though we know that was the Edge of History creative team's intent. They wanted to sort of, speaking of, rewrite history of National Treasure a little bit and imply that Ian was Cross S. Nostrum. I don't buy it because we know Ian wanted the treasure for the money. He was certainly not going to destroy that thing if he got his hands on it.
I agree with that. I will say that could it be possible that he could be Cross S. Nostrum with a different take on this preserving history thing, wherein he would sell that stuff to people like on the black market who weren't super gonna appreciate
He
the
was
historical significance?
absolutely going to do that, but I don't think that makes him jive with Cross S. Nostrum. I don't
Like,
think
you
you
think
get.
it still would have come out?
I think if he was Cross S. Nostrum, he was fully planning on double crossing Cross S. Nostrum and by taking the treasure in
I
some
like
way.
that.
Ooh, National Treasure 3? Sorry, focus. that being said, I do think this is maybe surprising to our listeners. I think that Cross S. Nostrum would be a pretty decent way to create a through line from the show to the movie if they were interested in having a through line. Now, something that's interesting, Emily, I didn't think of before this episode. We've talked about how someone like Agent Ross would be a natural person to appear in the movie to create such a through line. But we've never considered what about Billy as the villain? Could she be the through line by being a villain in National Treasure 3?
Ooh, I like that. I feel like the reason we didn't consider that is because we did not consider that Catherine Zeta-Jones would sign on for National Treasure 3, but we can hope.
I think, honestly, I think she'd be far more likely to sign for National Treasure 3 than a second season of the show. It's like big dollar signs, big profile, big budget, you know?
Definitely, I could buy that.
Okay. And I'll be honest, I don't hate the idea of having Billy as a National Treasure 3 villain. I really don't. Let's talk beyond the physical placement of a person in the movie. Could the motives of Cross-S Nostrum make their way into the film?
100%.
Totally.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say the opposite.
No, I think on National Treasure Hunt, in the thesis of our literal book, we talk about how National Treasure as a franchise remains relevant. And we have just talked for the last 45 or 60 minutes about how Cross-S Nostrum could be considered relevant to real life. And so, in that way, using Cross-S Nostrum in National Treasure 3 would make a ton of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it kind of has to happen now, in my opinion, but
Wow,
that's
that's
just me.
bold. Well, I mean, I still don't think they're going to
Oh, no, I don't think it'll happen, but I think like
it, though.
that would be the smart move.
I don't even know if I think it would be the smart move. I don't know that I want the show robustly referenced in the movie, but I do think it would work. That being said, I would not be surprised if Disney said no to putting Cross-S Nostrum in the movie because it would be a bigger political statement than Disney wants to make in a blockbuster setting, as opposed to the comparatively small slash niche Disney Plus audience.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I could see it. I could see it going either way. But yeah, I get what you're saying.
Seems hugely risky, especially because of the backlash that the show received for some of its, like, some of its plot lines that it explored. But that being said, I also just think they're going to hard pivot from interspersing such a big part of the show into the movie. Not only did John Turteltaub tell us that very fact on the red carpet before Edge of History even premiered, but now the show is also canceled on top of it. So why would they really truly have no incentive to make such a big part of the third movie hinge upon the show when they already weren't planning on doing that, when they didn't even know if the show was going to be the next big thing?
Yeah, especially because, like, it would mean that people would have to kind of watch the show.
I think there's a way to write it so that they don't have to watch it, but I think people would definitely being, I think they would think they have to watch it anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
So are we kind of on the same page, actually? I mean, you said you think Cross-S Nostrum has to be in the movie. I personally do not feel that strongly, but I think we both agree that it very well could fit.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. This is a little more kumbaya than I am used to at the end of a National Treasure Hunt episode. So, for our wrap up, Emily, I want to ask you a very subjective question. Did you like how the creative team used Cross-S Nostrum in the show?
I do. I think it was a very savvy choice for a villain. And I personally like that we were able to make an entire episode discussing Cross-S Nostrum, which I don't know would, I'm sure we'd find a way to do it, but I don't know that it would have been as easy, for, we didn't have a whole episode on Ian or on Mitch, like by themselves. I don't think it would have been as easy to have this kind of like deep conversation if the villain was a little more like straightforward. And I like the idea that the creative team made a villain that prompts, hopefully, people to kind of dive in and think a little bit.
I personally dare say that the villain might have been the best work they did on this show. I think that this is, for the purposes of pure storytelling, I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's such an interesting and traditionally unexplored villain motivation, everything that we've talked about today. It is truly unique, I think, in like a Disney portfolio. And it is complex and it is thought-provoking and it allows people to project their own belief systems on top of it, as we said today. And I think that's just really incredible. That being said, I just really wish they had spent more time exploring it. You know?
Yeah.
The quote, "Tomorrow is ours because yesterday is ours too," was such a bombshell, but we just breezed over it in the show. And that makes me really sad. It really does.
Yeah, I feel like we would have gotten more into it in season two.
Well, that's, I think, where we should really end the conversation today because we, as National Treasure Hunt, have been told exclusively that Cross S. Nostrum would have been a part of season two and that Billy would have been pulling the strings from prison. Which, is it that not a story you wanted to see? Certainly was for me.
100%.
But everything we talked about today was so broad and almost question-inducing. So I really hope that our listeners have a chance to reflect on our conversation and maybe weigh in themselves with how they interpret Cross S. Nostrum.
For sure. And if you would like to be one of those people, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We're also available on our website, ntnpodcast.com. And for more kind of like deep conversations like this, you can become a member of our Patreon at patreon.com/NTHuntPodcast.
We hope you've enjoyed today's conversation, and we're going to bring you back next time for something a little bit lighter. We're going to be doing one of our pop culture comparison episodes where we compare the National Treasure franchise to Lara Croft Tomb Raider.
Okay, Aubrey, just to make sure we don't have a repeat of the mummy situation, are you aware that there are two Lara Croft Tomb Raider movies?
Well, I am now. Which one are we watching?
We gotta do the original. Let's go with the 2001 version.
Okay, got it. So, everyone who's playing along at home, Lara Croft Tomb Raider 2001, that is what we're talking about next time. And until then, I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And thank you so much for joining us on our National Treasure Hunt.